Today is June 19, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 33 to 36 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's largest drone and missile campaign of the war, which struck Moscow's Kapotnia refinery and sent fuel rationing rippling across Russia, alongside the Royal Navy's first-ever seizure of a Russian Shadow Fleet tanker in the English Channel, and the U.S.-Iran Memorandum of Understanding signed at Versailles that's now reshaping the post-conflict energy order. Let's begin in Moscow, where the pre-dawn hours of the reporting period brought the largest Ukrainian strike on the Russian capital since the full-scale invasion began. According to political analyst Michael Shulman, appearing on Ukrainian broadcaster Channel 24, Russia's own Ministry of Defense confirmed approximately 994 drones and 6 missiles were deployed in the operation. The primary target was the Kapotnia oil refinery, located approximately 16 kilometers from the Kremlin, according to reporting cited by Jason Smart of the Kyiv Post. Shulman described Kapotnia as Moscow's largest refinery, supplying roughly 40% of the city's gasoline, 50% of its diesel, and 70% of the surrounding region's aviation fuel. Those numbers matter because they explain what happened next. Shulman reported that refinery equipment remained ablaze at the time of his broadcast, and that some equipment was destroyed outright, though independent damage assessments were not available. The immediate consequences, as Shulman described them, were striking: fuel shortages at Moscow filling stations, citywide traffic congestion, and the suspension of all flights at Moscow's 4 airports. Smart's reporting added that even before the strike, direct flights between Sochi and Moscow had already been canceled due to fuel shortages, and motorists on the Moscow to St. Petersburg highway were facing waits of approximately 3 hours just to obtain gasoline. This was not an isolated event. It sits within a sustained and intensifying campaign. According to reporting cited across multiple sources, Ukraine launched 30 drone strikes on Russian oil facilities in May alone, 16 of which directly struck major refineries. That campaign drove Russia's fuel production down 13% to its lowest level since 2009. Ukraine's Ministry of Defense reported separately that Ukrainian long-range strikes in 2026 are reaching targets at distances up to 1,750 kilometers, 2.5 times deeper than the strike ranges Ukraine achieved in 2022. The Economist, as cited by the Kyiv Post transcript, reported Ukraine is on track to complete 800 strikes on Russian territory by the end of 2026 if it maintains its current pace. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed these strikes directly before an assembled group of NATO and partner defense ministers, including NATO Secretary General Ruth, German Defense Minister Pistorius, and newly appointed UK Defense Secretary Jarvis. Zelensky linked the strikes on oil facilities and refineries in the Moscow region explicitly to losses in Russian federal budget revenue. He also referenced May's operations in detail. Ukraine conducted nearly 2,000 mid-range drone strikes in May at distances of 50 to 200 kilometers and destroyed 8,612 Russian vehicles and fuel tanks under the officially announced logistics lockdown program per Ukraine's defense forces. Russian air defense performance during the Kapotnia strike drew pointed criticism. Shulman noted that Russia's 3 concentric defensive rings around Moscow failed to intercept a large number of incoming drones. He cited Ukrainian drone unit costs at approximately $50,000 versus approximately $1 million per unit for Russian counter-drone missiles, an asymmetry he attributed to AI guidance systems embedded in Ukrainian platforms. Smart's reporting described instances of interceptor missiles striking buildings and firing after drone impacts had already occurred, characterizing Russian air defense as broadly ineffective during the large-scale attack wave. The Russian government's public posture was also notable. Per Shulman, President Putin was in Kazan attending a summit with a Philippine presidential delegation at the time of the Moscow strike. He did not return to the capital and issued no public statement. Russian state television broadcaster Vladimir Solovyov subsequently attributed the air defense failure not to the military but to Moscow residents for filming the attack. Police began making arrests of those who had documented the strike. The Battlefield Strike campaign and the broader dynamics of the post-Hormuz oil market have together produced measurable and compounding economic damage to the Russian state. Let's walk through the full picture. According to reporting cited across multiple sources, gas stations in Moscow and St. Petersburg are now rationing fuel to 20 liters per day per customer. Similar limits have been reported in Tatarstan and other regions. In occupied Crimea, authorities imposed a cap of 20 liters per person per week in late May, with fuel distributed via prepaid coupons that were described as selling out rapidly, and resellers charging double the standard price. A special hotline was established for tourists unable to leave the Crimean Peninsula. Russian media reported that nearly 80% of hotel bookings in Crimea were canceled. The infrastructure damage is deliberate and sustained. The Tuapse refinery on the Black Sea was struck three times in April and twice in May, preventing repair completion between attacks. Ukraine confirmed on June 14th that it had struck Tuapse port, identified in reporting as the origin point for 20% of Russia's seaborne oil exports. Smart's reporting also cited three additional strategic port targets, Novorossiysk, Primorsk, and Luga. Primorsk handles approximately 1 million barrels per day. Luga, approximately 700,000 barrels per day. Together, those two ports represent roughly 59% of Russia's seaborne oil exports. Smart further stated that the Russian government has spent over $20 billion, including approximately $10 billion in recent weeks, attempting to repair damaged refinery infrastructure without restoring full capacity. The Russian government's internal communications on the cause of these shortages have been contradictory in ways that themselves reveal the political sensitivity of the situation. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak was cited as attributing the production decline to, quote, unscheduled maintenance. The Russian Ministry of Energy subsequently issued a statement acknowledging, and I'm quoting here, that companies in the fuel and energy sector have been facing an increase in enemy airstrikes, leading to temporary difficulties with fuel supplies in a number of southern regions. That is a significant departure from the maintenance framing. The macroeconomic picture compounds the operational damage considerably. The Moscow Times reported that Russia revised its GDP growth forecast downward from 1.3% to 0.4%, with the economy contracting 0.3% in the first quarter of 2026. The Kiel Institute, in a June 11th publication, assessed that Russia's wartime economy has reached its limit. The numbers behind that assessment are stark. Assets in Russia's liquid sovereign wealth fund fell from 6.5% of GDP at the invasion's start to 1.8% in April 2026. Oil and gas revenues declined 45% year-on-year in the first quarter of 2026. Russia's federal budget deficit reached approximately 2.5% of GDP in the first 4 months of 2026, already exceeding the full-year 2025 deficit, and 46% of the Russian federal budget was directed toward the war in early 2026. Oil price dynamics had partially offset some of these losses during the Strait of Hormuz crisis, but that offset has now narrowed sharply. Russian Urals crude peaked at approximately $120 per barrel during the blockade, but following the U.S.-Iran agreement to reopen the strait, the price fell to approximately $72 per barrel, with Chinese and Indian buyers again demanding heavy discounts. A separate thread in this economic story involves what Smart characterized as state asset seizure operating under the guise of criminal enforcement. Two cases were cited. Ilya Traber, described as a St. Petersburg businessman affiliated with the Tambovskaya criminal organization and as a long-standing associate of President Putin, was arrested on official charges described as relating to organizing a killing, with Spain also having sought him in connection with criminal activity. A second figure, identified as Magomed, described as a Dagestani port owner with assets valued at over $1.6 billion, agreed to transfer those assets for approximately $750 million while facing the prospect of a life prison sentence. Smart characterized both cases as state asset seizure rather than criminal enforcement, though that framing is his own and not independently attributed. Now to the English channel, where the most operationally significant maritime enforcement action against Russia's oil export infrastructure to date took place, in the pre-dawn hours of June 14, Royal Marine Commandos, supported by officers from the National Crime Agency, conducted a boarding operation against the tanker Smirtos. UK Ministry of Defence confirmation was reported by Al Jazeera. The BBC described the operation as the first of its kind conducted by the UK against the Russian Shadow Fleet. The operation lasted 6 hours. Marines descended onto the vessel via ropes dropped from Chinook helicopters, with additional unnamed military aircraft, a Royal Navy frigate, and a mine-hunting vessel providing support. The National Crime Agency took one Indian national into custody on suspicion of sanction-related offenses. The remaining 24 crew members of Georgian and Indian nationality remained aboard while assisting the investigation. The Smirtos had departed Russia's Baltic port of Ust-Luga on June 5th, reportedly carrying approximately 700,000 barrels of oil, with Port Said, Egypt listed as its destination. Al Jazeera reported the ship is registered under a Hong Kong-based company, Zhaoyao Shipping Limited, which the outlet said owns several other sanctioned Shadow Fleet vessels, managed through a company based in Tamil Nadu, India. The immediate dispersal effect was striking. The iPaper reported that six Shadow Fleet tankers departed the English Channel within 77 minutes of the Smirtos seizure, becoming publicly known: the Maini, Kasser, Sona, Pate, Lion One, and Sea Viking. Three turned back toward Russia in Scandinavia. Three diverted toward Ireland. That kind of rapid, coordinated response suggests the Shadow Fleet is operating with a high degree of situational awareness. The legal basis for the operation had been established approximately 11 weeks prior, when UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer granted authorities the power to stop, board, and detain sanctioned vessels in UK waters in March. However, Al Jazeera reported that additional legal issues, including the cost of storing seized vessels, had to be resolved before the operation could proceed. BBC Verify reported on May 12 that 184 UK-sanctioned vessels had made 238 journeys through UK waters in the 7 weeks following Starmer's March statement. That figure illustrates both the scale of the problem and the gap between legal authority and operational action. The Royal Navy's website states that UK sanctions cover more than 500 Russian vessels, and that UK and Western sanctions contributed to a 24% decline in Russian oil and gas revenue in 2025, with a further decline of 45.4% in the first quarter of 2026. The Guardian estimated the Shadow Fleet generates between $87 billion and $100 billion in annual revenue for Russia, making it one of the most financially significant instruments keeping the Russian war economy afloat. On June 16, the UK announced a new sanctions package covering more than 20 additional vessels, as well as shipping services and insurers supporting the Shadow Fleet. France had conducted a comparable operation on June 1, seizing the Shadow Fleet vessel Tagore in Atlantic waters, with the UK deploying a helicopter from HMS Somerset to track the vessel. Prime Minister Starmer stated of the Smirtos operation, "This successful operation delivers yet another blow to Russia and reminds those fueling Putin's war in Ukraine that we will not let them hide." Building on that, United 24 Media reported on June 4th that most captured Shadow Fleet vessels are ultimately released due to an absence of European legislation enabling permanent seizure. The operational success of the Smirtos boarding, in other words, exists alongside a structural limitation that the UK and its partners have not yet resolved. Now to the diplomatic development with the broadest potential consequences for the global energy order, the Memorandum of Understanding between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran, signed at Versailles in the presence of French President Macron. The document was described across a Promethean Updates broadcast and corroborating coverage from the Rubin Report, which cited the New York Post. The MOU, described as approximately 14 paragraphs in length, was characterized as a 60-day framework instrument rather than a final agreement, a distinction that matters for how its provisions will be interpreted going forward. The key operative provisions, as described across both sources, are worth walking through carefully because they touch nearly every dimension of the relationship. First, an immediate permanent ceasefire encompassing Lebanon. Second, a mutual sovereignty clause prohibiting interference in each other's internal affairs. Third, an Iranian commitment to safe passage for commercial vessels through the Strait of Hormuz for 60 days, with subsequent governance arrangements to be defined through dialogue with the Sultanate of Oman and other Persian Gulf littoral states. Fourth, U.S. termination of all types of sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Fifth, U.S. Treasury issuance of immediate waivers for the export of Iranian crude, petroleum products, and derivatives, including banking transactions. Sixth, an Iranian reaffirmation that it shall not procure or develop nuclear weapons, with enriched nuclear material stockpiles to be addressed via downblending on site under IAEA supervision. And seventh, a $300 billion economic development and reconstruction package to be financed primarily through Gulf state investment, overseen by U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. U.S. release of previously frozen Iranian funds and assets was also included. Commentator Barbara Boyd, appearing on Promethean Updates, characterized the MOU's second paragraph, its acknowledgement of Iran as a sovereign state, as consistent with the Trump administration's broader foreign policy posture. She also noted that Lebanon was explicitly referenced in the document, describing that as significant given Lebanon's recent history. The $300 billion figure was described as not yet released and subject to finalization in subsequent negotiations. President Trump, responding to a question from Fox News correspondent Peter Doocy on how the administration would characterize the agreement as a victory, stated, "Here they lost militarily." Trump claimed Iran had possessed 159 ships at the outset of hostilities, all of which had been eliminated, along with Iran's air force. He also stated that continuing military operations would have depleted global oil reserves within approximately 4 weeks, a claim that a commentator in the Rubin Report transcript challenged in real time, noting the United States obtains virtually none of its energy from the affected region and has resumed domestic drilling. No resolution to that factual dispute was provided in the transcript. Trump additionally contrasted the MOU with the Obama-era Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, stating the prior deal was, in his words, a road to a nuclear weapon, and referencing the transfer of $1.7 billion in cash aboard a Boeing 757 to Iran under the previous administration. A Federal Reserve dimension was added by Promethean Updates commentator Susan Kokinda, who described remarks by new Fed Chairman Kevin Warsh rejecting forward guidance in favor of data-driven market responses as a, quote, regime change in monetary policy, a phrase she attributed to Warsh's own prior public statements. With the diplomatic and energy dimensions mapped, let's turn to the battlefield balance sheet, because the numbers tell a story that cuts against several months of Russian narrative. The Institute for the Study of War reported that in May 2026, Russia seized approximately 40 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory, while Ukraine liberated 280 square kilometers, a net Ukrainian gain of 240 square kilometers. In April, Russia took 28 square kilometers and lost 116 square kilometers, per the same institute. Ukrainian military sources stated Ukraine reclaimed more territory than it lost in May for the second consecutive month. The human cost to Russian forces, per multiple overlapping sources, is substantial. Zelensky stated before the assembled defense ministers that Russia is sustaining losses of at least 30,000 soldiers per month killed and seriously wounded. CSIS moderator Dr. Seth Jones cited U.S. estimates placing total Russian fatalities since February 2022 at approximately 425,000 killed. Ukraine's Ministry of Finance reported total Russian casualties, killed and wounded, exceeding 1.38 million since the invasion's start. Russian military recruitment in the first quarter of 2026 was 20% lower than the same period in 2025, notwithstanding signing bonuses described as reaching $80,000 and six-figure debt relief. Recruitment costs are estimated to account for 9.5% of Russia's federal budget. On the diplomatic track, reporting cited in multiple sources noted that President Trump spoke with President Putin by phone for approximately 1 hour and dispatched envoy Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner to Moscow. Putin advisor Yuri Ushakov was cited as stating Trump indicated readiness to exert influence on European partners and Kyiv at the G7 summit. Putin was quoted as claiming Ukrainian deep strikes changed nothing on the battlefield, though the same reporting noted the tension between that statement and Putin's decision to raise the strikes directly with the U.S. president during that same call. Zelensky, addressing the defense ministerial gathering, described the G7 summit in France as having produced a 5-point European peace plan. He separately announced a bilateral agreement signed at the meeting by Ukrainian and German defense ministers to combine technologies toward joint anti-ballistic missile capability, citing Ukrainian company Firepoint as moving toward ballistic missile production. He set a target of demonstrating concrete outcomes from joint anti-ballistic defense work by winter of the current year, and called on all countries to contribute to what he termed an anti-ballistic coalition. Zelensky also thanked the EU for a 90 billion euro support package and referenced the portal weapons delivery mechanism, noting that in one instance Patriot missiles were received the day before a Russian mass strike. He identified two urgent shortfalls, unmanned ground vehicles and long-range artillery ammunition, and said 15 NATO countries and 12 non-NATO countries are involved in the drone coalition. He urged partner nations to prepare financial instruments for the post-conflict period ahead of the NATO summit in Ankara. On civilian casualties, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights confirmed 16,126 Ukrainian civilian deaths and 46,590 injuries from Russian strikes as of May 31. A Russian strike on June 15 killed 11 people. That same day, a Russian strike set fire to the Assumption Cathedral at the Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra, a historic church dating to the 11th century. An unusual and significant diplomatic signal emerged from Minsk this week. In a June 15 interview with Al-Arabiya, reported by the Kyiv Post, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko called for peace between Russia and Ukraine and stated that Belarusian involvement in the conflict would be, his word, absurd. That is a remarkable rhetorical reversal for a leader who permitted Russian forces to use Belarusian territory as a staging ground for the February 24, 2022 invasion. Per the Kyiv Post transcript, over 30,000 Russian troops entered Belarus under the guise of a training exercise before the invasion and subsequently crossed the 1,084-kilometer Belarus-Ukraine border. Lukashenko also issued an apology to Ukrainian President Zelensky, quoting directly, "If Volodymyr Oleksandrovich was offended, I apologize to him for these words," in reference to prior statements in which Lukashenko had called Zelensky scum and a Nazi. He described Belarus as militarily exposed. "Belarus is very vulnerable militarily, because Belarus is exposed to the Ukrainian military like we are in the open palm of their hand." He also stated he had previously told Putin it was absolutely unacceptable for the war between Ukraine and Russia to spill over onto the territory of Belarus. The reversal carries important context. Less than 1 month before the Al-Arabiya interview, on May 21, Belarus conducted joint exercises with Russia involving intercontinental ballistic missiles, attended by both Putin and Lukashenko, designed to prepare Belarusian soldiers to deploy tactical nuclear weapons on Russia's command. On May 12, Lukashenko declared selective military mobilization following exercises involving 6,000 reservists. In January 2025, he stated he had no regrets about allowing Russia to use Belarus as an invasion staging ground. So what changed? The Kyiv Post attributed Lukashenko's shift to a reassessment of Russian reliability as a guarantor. Three cases were cited as inflection points: the fall of Syria's Bashar al-Assad in December 2024, during which Russia did not intervene; the detention of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro; and the killing of Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei during what the transcript identifies as Operation Epic Fury. In none of these cases did Russia provide material support to its partners beyond condemnation. The military balance reinforces Lukashenko's exposed position. The Kyiv Post cited reporting that 80% of Belarusians oppose their country's participation in the conflict. Ukrainian MP Roman Bezmertny, cited via the New Voice of Ukraine, stated Belarus maintains a conscript army of approximately 46,000 soldiers but faces a, quote, colossal shortage of ammunition and equipment, particularly armored vehicles, with Russia having siphoned off most of Belarus's stockpiles. Global firepower data, cited in the transcript, reported Ukraine holds 900,000 active military personnel, 4 million reservists, spends $45 billion per year on defense, and holds double the number of aircraft and tanks compared to Belarus, along with close to 40,000 more armored vehicles. A different dimension of the conflict, the future shape of the forces that may define the next phase of great power competition, was on display this week at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and U.S. Naval Institute's 2026 Maritime Security Dialogue Series. Lieutenant General Ray Austin, Commanding General of Marine Corps Combat Development Command, and newly appointed Portfolio Acquisition Executive for Marine Corps Ground Programs, outlined the service's modernization posture before an audience that Austin stated that, as of the event date, more than 42,000 Marines were forward deployed or stationed in 49 countries and aboard ship. He identified three top warfighting priorities: closing joint kill webs, lethality, and logistics in contested environments. The Marine Corps has fielded five programs of record in ground-based air defense, including MADIS and LMADIS counter-UAS systems. The fiscal year 2027 budget accelerates those investments, as well as the Navy Marine Expeditionary Ship Interdiction System, known as NEMESIS. Marine Corps Attack Drone Team was established in January of the prior year as a joint venture between Marine Corps Warfighting Lab and Weapons Training Battalion at Quantico. Austin described attack drones as now operationally deployed with Marine expeditionary units and employed as crew-served weapons within infantry formations, meaning individual infantry squads are operating drones the same way they operate crew-served weapons like machine guns. He cited three barriers that had to be addressed over approximately 18 months to get there: spectrum management, battery storage, and weapons certification of explosive payloads. On force structure, Austin reported a four-month analytical review identified approximately 18,000 positions of potential structural need, winnowed to approximately 9,000 positions recommended to the commandant, with emphasis on unmanned systems. He described Force Design 2030 as approximately 60-70% correct at inception, citing former Commandant General David Berger's own assessment of the plan he authored. Combatant commander demand for amphibious ready group and marine expeditionary unit pairings exceeds the service's steady-state production target by more than twice. That is a significant gap. Three ARG-MEU pairings were simultaneously deployed approximately 1 month prior to the event: the 11th, 22nd, and 31st MEUs. The 31st redeployed from 7th Fleet to 5th Fleet on short notice, a flexibility that matters in a period of simultaneous crises. The 22nd MEU completed a 10-month deployment, encompassing humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, and combat operations, including support to U.S. Southern Command in Venezuela. The Landing Ship Medium program was described as, in Austin's words, late to need, though he expressed confidence that metal bending on the first article would occur in the current year. Austin confirmed that China remains the pacing threat in the Marine Corps, strategic guidance. CSIS moderator Dr. Seth Jones, noting Russian fatalities in the full-scale war at approximately 425,000 killed per U.S. estimates, linked Ukrainian attack drone employment directly to Russian infantry attrition in the kill zone, an observation Austin did not contest. The implication being that the lessons of this war are actively shaping how the Marine Corps is preparing for the next one. Finally, two independent reporting threads point toward a systematic distortion of the information flows reaching President Putin himself, and they are worth examining together because they illuminate the internal governance problem facing the Kremlin. The Moscow Times and United 24 Media reported on June 15th citing Dmitry Skorbatov, former editor-in-chief of the Vesti program on Russian state broadcaster Rossiya 1, that a project codenamed The Main Viewer has since 2011 produced separate, curated news broadcasts delivered exclusively to President Putin, distinct from those seen by the Russian public. Skorbatov described receiving instructions after regular broadcasts to alter content, retaining, adding, embellishing, or removing items to present a favorable portrayal of Russia and of Putin's presidency. The New Voice of Ukraine reported on May 29th that Putin's military commanders have been providing him with false maps that inflate Russian territorial gains. No official Russian response to either claim appeared in the transcript. Putin himself stated on June 13th that Russian soldiers, quote, can't raise their heads because of Ukrainian drones, an acknowledgement that stands in some tension with official battlefield narratives. And documents described by Zelensky as obtained by Ukrainian intelligence from Russian government systems reportedly project Putin's approval rating could fall to 55% and support for United Russia to 22% ahead of parliamentary elections scheduled by September. The document's authenticity has not been independently verified. The economic data underlying domestic sentiment is unfavorable by almost any measure. Sweden's foreign minister, Maria Malmer Stenergard, said analysis of Russia's nighttime luminosity index, a satellite-based measure of economic activity, suggests the country's GDP contracted 8% between 2020 and 2024. That stands against the Kremlin's official claim of 13% growth over the same period. Russia's central bank raised interest rates to 21% in response to inflation, the Kremlin reported at 10% in 2024. Swedish military intelligence assessed actual Russian inflation at closer to 15% during the same period. Building on that, a potential new mobilization wave, if required due to volunteer shortfalls, would further strain the implicit social contract between the Kremlin and the Russian public. The recruitment numbers cited earlier, 20% lower in the first quarter of 2026 than the same period in 2025, despite $80,000 signing bonuses, suggest that contract is already under pressure. Taken together, the picture that emerges from this briefing is one of compounding asymmetries. Ukraine is striking deeper, at lower cost per platform, with improving effectiveness against critical infrastructure. The maritime enforcement architecture around Russia's shadow fleet is activating for the first time with operational boarding actions. The U.S.-Iran framework, whatever its final shape, has already brought Hormuz crude prices down nearly $50 a barrel from their peak, narrowing the windfall that had been partially cushioning Russia's fiscal deterioration. And the information environment inside the Kremlin, between what Putin is being shown and what is actually happening, appears to be widening rather than narrowing. Those threads will continue to develop. We'll be watching them. That's your geopolitics briefing for June 19, 2026. This is Briefing Desk. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.